what we found is that based on the genomics of isolates, they all kind of made their own fatty acids. And what we found out is that through the DNA backwards approach I was talking about, many of them can actually pull in fatty acids from the environment. And if they do that, that saves, you know, like if it's 16-0 as a predominant one, that's 16 carbons.
Palmitic acid. Saves, yep.
Yeah, that palmitic acid, that saves the equivalent of 8 acetates being produced.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Hi-D from DSM Firmenich optimizes vitamin D levels to increase milk yield, enhance calcium to phosphorus ratio, and strengthen immunity. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd. Lallemand Animal Nutrition, partnering in microbial solutions for a changing world.
Hello and welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University, and I am honored to welcome to the show Dr. Jeff Firkins today. Jeff is a distinguished professor in the College of Food, Ag, and Environmental Sciences at The Ohio State University. Jeff, thanks for joining today.
Glad to be here. Always a pleasure to interact with you, young man.
Well, I was thinking before we got on, I doubt you remember, but the first time I really kind of got to know you is about 20 years ago at a meeting in Denmark, and all the Americans were kind of hanging out together, and I just remember. Man, what a smart guy, and so generous with your time, and I've appreciated your mentoring over the years, for sure. But let's, for the audience sake, let's step back. How did you get into animal science and your focus in microbiology?
Well, I was, like a lot of people, interested in being a veterinarian. I grew up on a farm, and we had all kinds of, we basically had every animal. My uncle was 2 miles away and had a dairy farm. My dad sold his cows when I was too young to really remember. And so I was going to do that or fall back to go be a feed salesman or something. And then I took nutrition and microbiology in the same semester as a sophomore. And I don't know, that was the light bulb for me. So I've always loved it. I took many microbiology classes at the University of Illinois, which was, of course, the birthplace for the modern technology that we use today all the time. So I was right there on the ground floor when all that was happening. It was really cool. So that's how I got into it.
I know you did your PhD at Illinois. Was that your undergrad as well?
Yeah. Illinois. Yeah, okay. I'm from North Central Illinois.
And how long have you been at Ohio State now?
38 years.
Okay. Pretty impressive.
1987.
Is there like one paper or one concept that you look back and say, you know, this is maybe my biggest contribution or most thing that you're most proud of?
Yeah. So, you know, when we came up with a protozoal 18S marker, I remember sitting in Mark Morrison's office when, you know, kind of just came across it. And that's been widely used. But I think the thing I'm most proud of is basically interacting with Tim Hackman at Davis and kind of going through the first time we started seeing the way that some of the bacteria make energy in a way that's different than what the classical sense is. And just going through the genomes when they were first coming out and just such an explosive work. So I think the work with him was, I still just think it's so exciting that we were able to find it. And actually interacting with probably the expert on that in the world, he started contacting me, and I'm like, well, actually Tim was the one who really did more of it. And so those two worked a lot together, this fellow from Switzerland. So it was really, really interesting.
That's exciting. Maybe for some of the audience, we should step back and could you talk us through like what kingdoms of life are found in the rumen for one thing? And then what you referred to like the genomic revolution, right? Just real quickly talk us through how that changed microbiology.
So when I was a grad student, there were 50 species of bacteria, right? And, so while I was doing my PhD, this guy named Carl Woese at University of Illinois started looking at the small subunit of ribosomes of bacteria. And they were looking at isolates, and then they looked at methanogens, and they go, wow, these aren't different. They're not the same at all. They're completely different. And so they figured out, well, they're split into what they used to call a domain, trying to figure it out. Now, most people call it kingdom, like you say. And so there's them. There's some kind of ones in the middle still trying to figure out. But clearly bacteria, archaea, there's lots of viruses in the rumen, surprisingly, they found, and protozoa and fungi, the key ones. And they all can be distinguished primarily by most of what's being done is with the small subunit. And that's because at the time it was like the Goldilocks version of that was, it was big enough to have information, but the larger subunit was too big for the sequencing power they had at that time. So they chose the small subunit. And so that's kind of become the rock that everything else stands on. But of course now whole genome sequencing is really taking over and is clearly the future. We'll be past 16S in 5 years or so, I think. 16S is the small subunit.
And the basic shift over 50 years or whatever has been, instead of having to culture bacteria to describe them, which there's still value in that, right? But it's almost impossible to culture some of these. Now we can just look at their DNA and at least know that they're there, right?
Which, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Most estimates are something about, we've cultured about representing about 10%. There's some really key ones that haven't really been cultured, but we know what they do by sort of backwards genomic sequencing. Actually, I was here working with a microbiologist at OSU, and they came up with a way to do this backward filling in of the pathways they had to break down fiber and then the fermentation pathways. And it's really, really interesting. And so I've been kind of lucky to be with some really smart microbiologists and I guess smart enough to be able to understand what they were doing and inquisitive enough, I guess, to keep at it. So yeah, it's really revolutionary now. And now these metagenome assembled genomes, I don't know why they call them that. It's a MAG. But they're sort of becoming more and more predominant. And like my colleagues, ETU, and I have, especially him, though, have been aligned with a group that takes a single protozoal cell, and they're able to sequence the genome of a single cell.
Wow.
And so now there's, you know, something like 100 genomes of them. So it's totally revolutionary with how people are doing it, to the point where I got to say, you know, sound like a curmudgeon here, but there's a lot of people that say a lot of things that if they knew the microbiology behind it, they wouldn't be saying. So okay. We have to go back to people actually understanding the physiology and ecology of these microbes and not just the DNA that's there. So we have to get there. And of course, the future really is RNA and protein, you know, like the kind of work you do. It's definitely right on the doorstep.
Elevate animal performance with Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Berg & Schmidt.
This ties in well with your point there of like, we have to put this in context of the animal, right? So what we really want to talk about today is, I think, a really interesting application of understanding rumen bacteria in thinking about how fats that we feed dairy cattle might influence those bacteria and what they do, which then turns around and influences the animal. So could you start off just kind of giving a 50,000 foot view of like, how do people typically think about fatty acids influencing rumen bacteria?
Bacteria are about 10% fatty acids. They have membranes. Gram negatives have two membranes, And so fatty acids are really critical for them. We still don't know exactly what controls the regulation of them, but we know that they have to be synthesized enough for cell growth. Every time one cell turns into two, everything has to be doubled, right? So all these fatty acids have to be either incorporated or made and then put in a membrane, mostly membranes. What we found is that based on the genomics of isolates, they all kind of made their own fatty acids. And what we found out is that through the DNA backwards approach I was talking about, many of them can actually pull in fatty acids from the environment. And if they do that, that saves, you know, like if it's 16O as a predominant one, that's 16 carbons.
Palmitic acid. Saves, yep.
Yeah, that palmitic acid, that saves the equivalent of 8 acetates being produced.
Huh.
Yep. So it's, you know, in microbiology, they talk about carbon. They don't talk about energy in the same way that we do. We think about like net energy of lactation. And so it's the, if they can take in a fatty acid and take a couple of ATPs to be able to incorporate it into a lipid, well, that saved them the ability to make 8 acetates. So that net generates them or spares the ability to make a whole lot more energy. So when they're really growing rapidly and competing with other microbes for substrate, though, you know, the ability to have things kind of all that they need all in the same soup inside their cell allows them to grow more efficiently and sort of outcompete the next one. So it's a kind of a newer topic that goes back. I just gave a presentation last week. It's like Back to the Future. I feel like Marty McFly. But we've known this. People have known this since the 1960s. It's just sort of kind of got lost in this. And so, yeah, they're taking up fatty acids. And if we provide them to them, it seems to make them a little more fit. And it seems like the bacteria that break down fiber, they really like to have 16O and not 18O, whereas a bunch of the other bacteria will like 18O or stearic acid. And so 16O seems to be a little better. Probably, we don't really know, but probably 18O is probably enough larger that it's a little less soluble, a little harder to be pushed through their membrane to be charged and then used. So it probably wants to kind of embed in the membrane more than it wants to be pulled through and used. So 16O probably passes through a little bit better. And then some of the unsaturated fatty acids, microbes don't really take up 18.2 linoleic acid very much. Protozoa do. But bacteria, they seem to like oleic acid, 18.1, and they kind of, as they're growing, if they need more fluidity, they would take up more 18.1. If they need less fluidity, they would take up more 16.0. So they kind of take them as they go. And then I just have to mention that the other main way that they maintain fluidity is with branched fatty acids that result from elongation of branch chain VFA or iso acids. So that's a key role why especially the cellulitics need iso acids to grow effectively.
So, yeah, you mentioned a lot about palmitic, which is an example of a saturated fat, and then stearic acid, a saturated fat, and then you mentioned some unsaturated. I guess big picture, how does this interface with if you fed a lot of linoleic acid like you find in corn, for example? We know there's negative effects of that, right? And then we know there's this process called biohydrogenation. How does that interface with what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a really key point to think about. So bacteria can use 18.2 linoleic acid. They biohydrogenate it. And probably some of the trans fatty acids can wind up in their membrane, but just not that much. And so the bacteria that are most prominent at biohydrogenating, they have a higher concentration of 16O palmitic, and they have a really high concentration of branched lipids. It's probably probably because the biohydrogenation is occurring right there at their membrane. You know, they're not going inside the cell to be biohydrogenated. It's right there and they're using reducing equivalents generated inside the cell. So it's right at the membrane and using transmembrane proteins to do that. So maintaining the fluidity to do that is really critical. So again, 16.0 and 18.1, along with the branch ones, are the key ones for them, especially the biohydrogenating butyrovibrioles.
So you mentioned the cellulolytic bacteria that are fiber digesting seem to have a different preference for these fatty acids compared to some other species. So how does that play into net fiber digestion ability for the cow and in the overall rumen?
You know, when Don Palmquist was doing this work, you know, way back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we figured out that when you feed more forage, you know, the lipids, the unsaturated lipids kind of want to, you know, they want to stay with themselves, right? Their oil and water don't mix. So they kind of want to adhere to the lipid portion of fiber particles. Well, that's where the fiber digesters are hanging out. So they're right there at the same place. So as the unsaturated lipids, they're looking either for particles or for the bacteria that are on the particles. That's where they're wanting to bind. And so they can, they could become toxic and overwhelm the cellulolytics. Really, their hemicellulose digesters are the main biohydrogenators. But you could overwhelm them if there's too much unsaturated fatty acids. But if you only put in a moderate amount, a couple of percent in the diet, and you don't have a whole bunch all at one time, they can sort of keep up with that, and biohydrogenation doesn't become toxic. We know that the main ones that do the biohydrogenating, they do that as part of their normal physiological process. So people have found out they have to be growing rapidly to biohydrogenate. And if they're growing slowly, they don't biohydrogenate very well. They need, like I said, they need the reducing equivalents inside their cells to do that. And so to maintain good fiber breakdown, good growth of those fiber digesters, they can keep up with biohydrogenation. You just can't have so much of that fat or it starts in kind of inhibiting them. And then other ones that biohydrogenate, as you know, through the trans-10 pathway, they are more prevalent in a lower pH environment, more starch, and they start competing and you start building up more of the trans-10 isomer. And so it's probably partly because the higher starch inhibits the normal ones that we want, the ones that break down hemicellulose. But it probably also makes the fatty acids more inhibitory to them to have more starch. So it's not just the starch, it's the combination with the unsaturated fat that's toxic to them. And so a good rumen environment the nutritionist doesn't allow these low pH kind of things, really high starch combined with a lot of unsaturated fat. That's one of the things I kind of have always liked about being able to add fat in a diet. It's providing energy, and then you don't have to rely so much on starch, you know, to do that. So it kind of allows a little bit more moderate environment for the fiber digesters.
Classically, and you can correct me if I mischaracterize this some, but you know, in the last, like you said, since Don Palmquist really started this, there's been development of calcium salts and then like prilled fat sources with the basic idea of it, at least, I don't like the word bypass, but at least limiting interactions of the fats with the rumen microbes is kind of the way I talk about it, because mostly you want to get it to the intestine to be absorbed. Okay, but the way you're talking about this, at least for some fatty acids, like maybe palmitic and oleic acids, some of the bacteria that we really want to promote, the fiber digesters, may benefit from availability of these fatty acids in the rumen, right? Which is, to me, at least for a lot of nutritionists, probably a different way of thinking. How does that influence the way you think about, you know, optimal supply of fatty acids?
Yeah, I think basically what you said, I would just follow along and say we really need to maintain a balance of unsaturated fat that doesn't go too much, too high. If as those fatty acids are being biohydrogenated, that's probably a good thing. for the fiber users. They can take up some of that. The protozoa take up 18.2, and that seems to be good for them. We're finding that they're involved in fiber breakdown too. We used to give them a secondary role, but the genomics and proteomic studies they just keep pointing to a major role for them. And so clearly lipids are having an involvement in that. I think, you know, it sort of makes sense to me what's going on, because if you think evolutionarily about these microbes in the rumen, they've been around where there's a lot of lipids. You know, when they graze forages, chloroplasts are just full of 18.2. And so they're around that. They've learned how to live with the lipids, and if they, there's always going to be somebody that learns how to take advantage of it, something too. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question very well, other than I just think there's a role for fat in the diet, not just for energy, but to maintain and improve possibly fiber digestibility. The studies that Adam Locke has done, and like the studies that we've seen where we've used those in continuous cultures, typically we see something like 3-4% improvement in fiber digestibility, independent of anything else. And that isn't going to happen if you let the pH go low, if you, you know, overwhelm with starch and so on. But in a sort of balanced diet, there is a place for fat to support the fiber degrading microbes.
Compared to stuff from 30 or 40 years ago, you know, that's such a paradigm shift of like, okay, fat might be worth it because you can get more energy to the cow, but you have to worry about, you're probably going to hurt fiber digestion, right? Is what I always had in my head. And this says with certain types of fatty acids, that's probably the opposite is true.
You know, when I was on NASM, I had a long conversation with Lou Armentano about that. And that is that's the dogma. Let's face it. But a lot of those studies, if you go and look at them, like, for example, there's a key one and they added 10% fat. I don't think we feed 10% fat to cows. Or I remember, you know, I was talking about this to somebody else the other day, but I remember saying, well, I got to see a treatment response, so I'm going to put in 5% unsaturated fat. And we get our feed in paper bags, and the bags were all oily because we put in so much fat. Yeah. And so what Lou opened my eyes about is if you take out those ones that are feeding more fat than we would ever feed because it will cause milk fat depression or decrease dry matter intake, if you step back down, there really isn't a negative effect of fat if you look through the studies at that more moderate approach. So it's a dogmatic shift, but maybe it shouldn't be.
Yeah, that's important insight, I think.
Yeah, the information out there is really pretty clear. If you have a moderate fat diet, moderate unsaturated fat, the rumen can keep up with it, and it's fine. Now, if you're going to add more fat to improve energy density of the diet and so on, then there's a role, like you were talking about, palmitic acid, and palmitic needs to have some oleic in it to be digestible. And the thing I've looked at, based on the microbiology studies, probably what's pretty good to maintain a good palmitic acid digestibility in the small intestine, blending that with oleic, that's probably about kind of along the lines of what the microbes take up too. You have to kind of go through the studies and see, well, they didn't add fat in these studies. And you go and look at what did they add? They added yeast culture. And what is yeast full of? 16.0 and 18.1.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, so if you start looking through it, you start seeing the picture that, like I was talking about earlier. So I'm very confident that if balanced correctly, fat won't limit fiber digestibility, never really did, and has the potential to improve it.
And when you say, just to be clear, when you say moderate feeding rates, you're talking like 4.5 to 5.5% fatty
total,
acids?
Total added, yeah, fatty acids. And, a couple of percent of of an unsaturated source that's, you know, not inert, like you were talking about, they probably can keep up with that. And then as you start adding more of that, you know, of course you're increasing the risk of milk fat depression or decreased intake as well. So yeah, so a couple of percent of a basal fat source like whole soybeans, but you know, I was on the ground floor when we did these partially hydrogenated tallows. Like I remember the first studies we did were with tallow triglycerides. There is, you know, I mean, then we figured out, oh, they have to be fatty acids, not triglycerides, right, to help improve the digestibility. But, you know, we were feeding like 5% of that stuff. And you had to kind of be careful walking out where the cows are because it was slippery. I mean, it was, you could see, we took these pictures like from rumen cannulated cows, and you could just see these little BBs of fat just hanging, floating around. And we collect duodenal samples and the fat BBs just floated on the top. You know, it's really hard to collect a representative sample to find it. I mean, so we grossly overdid the saturation, and then we found out, well, that has to be blended properly. And of course, companies came in and figured that out using iodine value and so on. How much can you feed of that? The fat industry has done a really good job of trying to figure out how to optimize fatty acid digestibility. And so, I mean, there's no doubt about that. They've really, really improved that in my career. It's the ability to use fats is so much better than it was. But back when Don Palmquist started, I mean, everybody, he was alone. He was a lone ranger talking about it. Nobody else was feeding fat. I remember when I was doing my PhD, I'm like, well, you know, fat, you know, and then not everybody, I wouldn't say everybody, but, you know, it's just widely used.
Quite an impact. One other topic then, before we run out of time here, you know, another sort of secondary way to alter energy available to the cow by feeding fats is potentially to influence methane production, because methane is a loss of about, what, 8% of gross energy intake, also has climate implications. So what are your thoughts on fatty acids to alter that?
Yeah, so maybe, as you know, I've been on several international projects for that. And there's some groups really trying to figure out, and it's all about optimization, how to get enough to inhibit methanogens, but not so much to cause problems. We were first doing a lot of work with the medium chain fatty acids like coconut oil. And sometimes it would work spectacularly. And I remember I did a study with it, and it dropped intake like, you know, they just, you know, it just really hit them. Those medium chains, as you know, bypass the lymphatic system, go right to the liver. They eventually get to the liver and seem to cause some kind of feedback that limits feed intake. And they can also, they're really toxic to methanogens, but to a whole bunch of things. So that concept didn't work. People are using different kinds of, like, seeds, safflower seeds and so on. If they can get it so they get enough in there to be inhibitory, but not so much to cause milk fat depression or reduced intake, then there's a role for it. And it's also part of it, not just through inhibiting methanogens, but also probably improving feed efficiency. If you get the right amount of fat in, you should be able to do that. In the methane research right now, the thing that just stands out that everybody's trying to figure out is the hydrogen is the precursor for methane. A whole bunch of microbes make hydrogen. Probably about two-thirds make hydrogen or use hydrogen. So it's all over the place. And then they emit that. And so people are trying to find unique ways to decrease that. That hydrogen, if it gets, instead of making hydrogen, it goes into propionate, and you're the expert on propionate, you know, then we probably are improving energetics, improving feed efficiency and so on. Like Paul Kononoff just had a paper looking at inhibiting methane, and it improved energetics. that's what we want. Not every study does that. And so why is this hydrogen escaping, and what can we do to get other microbes to use it instead, especially to turn it into propionate or a longer chain fatty acid besides acetate? That's the goal. If we can get that right, then we can double dip and depress methane while improving feed efficiency. So I would just love to see us be able to do that, because, you know, it's something we can do. I always tell people, we in dairy nutrition, we didn't cause climate change. And there hasn't even been that much more methane emitted by ruminants over the years, because cows increase their milk production, so we have fewer cows, and it takes 2 years to make a cow. Bison
anyway, right?
Yeah, so we're not really contributing that much. It hasn't changed. It's not us in dairy nutrition. But I always say we can be part of the solution, and I would love to see that be more successful, and, you know, consumers need to buy into it, I feel, to make that work. But if we can do that, that's the way to go. And we definitely can inhibit methane without disrupting the rumen, but we have to be careful not to use ways that do disrupt the rumen, because I always say, if you want, I can show you how to make skim milk.
Right.
If everybody wanted that, that's not too hard. But, of course, we don't want that.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergenschmidt Animal Nutrition. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from AffiMilk. Visit AffiMilk.com to learn more. That's AffiMilk.com. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. Natural Biologics is using cutting-edge science to deliver cost-effective solutions for the animal health and productivity challenges you face. For conventional or organic production systems, Natural Biologics can help support rumen health and immune function, mitigate pathogens, and increase production efficiency. Visit naturalbiologics.com to learn more.
Great. All right. Well, we've got our three famous questions to throw at you. So let's see what you got up your sleeve here. First of all, what's your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
Well, of course, I use NASEM a lot, the book. It's just sitting here. I contributed to this book called Improving Rumen Function. And for me, I use that one a lot. There's some really good chapters in that. Over and over, I've had my students read chapters. It's really good. So those are the two that are at the top of the pile, you know, behind my, that you can't see, but they're sitting there.
And you of course contributed a lot to NASEM as well. So huge impacts there. What year was the book, the Improving Rumen Function?
I think it was 2020.
Okay.
It's still very relevant though.
What about your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
Well, I have to say, I do. I'm a Bible reader, but my favorite book of all time is the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So, I went to the outdoor theater up by Cleveland, where they had the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra play all the background music. It was just amazing. Wow. I mean, so I went and reread the books and watched the movies again.
So I was going to ask you, you're like, some of the people who love the books, you know, were movie haters of the movies, but you thought they were pretty well done.
You know, I think, you know, they to me, they left out the last chapter. That's like, oh, you have to go back and read the last chapter of the third book, because I know it was too long, but the movies were already too long. But that just made it for me. So anybody who's a reader of that, go back and, or if you haven't read the books, you just at least read the last chapter.
It's been probably 20 years since I've read them, so I need to go back and do that again.
The Hobbits put Saruman in his place, so they become much more brave and get all the other ones to do that.
All right. So in your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
Yeah, I thought a lot about that one. And to me, like everything, it's time management. You have to figure out how to make things work. But the people who I know are really good, they seem to have a really strong ability to maintain a relationship with their clients. None of them are looking for somebody else to do something better. They follow up. When there's an issue that happens, they address it. A really good dairy nutritionist, once they happened to have a farm that had a rumen cannulated cow and took a picture inside and sent me this picture. And I went and talked to a vet over here and was like, oh, that's, you know, classic, you know, clostridial issue. And, you know, so to me, I always thought the really good people, they kind of use the experimental method. You know, you start out with looking at observations, you start formulating hypotheses, you follow up, you read or you talk to other people, and then you check it. And so the really good ones are just good thinkers all the way through and maintain that relationship. I always think like they sort of are treating their clients the way they would want to be treated if they were a client, the golden rule. And that's basically how I can sum up my impression of what people out there do.
Both people smart and technical smart, the kind of what sounds like you're saying.
Yeah. And the other thing is I see them at conferences. They're following along with somebody like you was saying, and they might not know all the mechanics behind it, all the science, but they know why that's important and they know what to take out of it that they can use. Yeah. They're always evolving.
Very good. Well, one last question, you know, off the script here. I know you're a faithful Buckeye fan. What's the fall season shaping up to look like for Ohio State?
Every time I turn around, they're trying to get another quarterback. So, of course, that's a huge role in who stays and doesn't transfer. Yep. And so on. They're going to have a really good team. You know, Penn State's looking pretty good right now, and from what I understand, Penn State better be really good or there'll be somebody else transferring into another coaching position. So there's a lot of pressure on, you know, on their coach, Franklin, like there was last year for our coach. I mean, there's a huge amount of pressure how they go about doing it and getting the right people. But they're definitely going to be really solid. We still have maybe the best receiving coach and, well, definitely the best receiver in college. We can get somebody that can hit him open. The line is, both lines, I guess, have been rebuilding and are looking pretty good from what I hear. So, and we always have good running backs. So, yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, we're looking forward to it. I got my season ticket on the 50-yard line. That's the good thing about being here for 38 years.
Yeah. Yes.
It's actually on the 49-yard line.
Well, it's been a lot of fun talking with you, Jeff. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, I'm glad to be. I really admire all that you give back to the dairy industry as well as the research community. So thanks for asking. It's an honor in return to be asked by you.
Thanks very much. Again, this has been Dr. Jeff Firkins as our guest today on the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. If you haven't followed the show yet, make sure you click that button so you don't miss the next episode. And we'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.